From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. This is a special edition of Texas Matters, investigating the surge of immigrants, unaccompanied minors, turning up at the Texas southern border by going to the source, Tegucigalpa, Honduras. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Arriving at the Tegucigalpa, Honduras airport, I was a little more than on edge. And it wasn't just the capital city's infamous short runway and death-defying landing. I had been told that Honduras was a dangerous place. Now, I'm accustomed to reporting in places like Mexico and along the border, but I was warned that things were different in Honduras. One journalist friend told me to expect to be kidnapped or murdered, and other experienced journalists and people familiar with the region echoed that warning. One guy on Facebook messaged me and said he was an experienced traveler of Honduras, and he'd been once beaten up and robbed at 11 o'clock in the morning while walking down a busy Tegucigalpa street. He said I was either being very brave or very foolish. I certainly didn't know which one I was, but I needed to make this trip. I wanted to get to the heart of this story. Honduras is the murder capital of the world. According to a 2012 United Nations report, there were 90 homicides for every 100,000 people. And in Honduras, that statistic means in this nation of 8 million people, as many as 20 are killed here every day. The day after I arrived, the U.S. State Department renewed its travel warning for Honduras, saying crime and violence remain critically high. The State Department noted that Honduras has had the world's highest murder rate since 2010 and that the government lacks the resources to address the issue. The warning pointed out that the Honduran police have been known to take part in such crimes as murder and car theft, and that the police force doesn't have the cars or gasoline to respond to reports of violent crime. The warning did say that the Honduran government has increased police presence at the main tourist sites, such as the resorts and the Copan Mayan ruins, but it says visitors are at risk of murder, robbery, and attacks on tourist vans elsewhere, including the large cities of San Pedro Sula and Tegucigalpa. Honduras is also the second poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, after Haiti. According to the World Bank, 70% of the population live in poverty, 36% live in extreme poverty. That means severe deprivation of basic human needs, including food, safe drinking water, sanitation, and shelter. Another grim factoid about Honduras: it's also the top nation for the killing of journalists. There was a military coup here 5 years ago, and since then there have been many crackdowns on human rights. Reporters who have bravely written or broadcast negative reports about the current regime and about the issues surrounding indigenous people being forced off their ancestral land have been kidnapped, tortured, and murdered. But that's not the story that brought me to Honduras, although I wish I could have reported on that. I was here because Honduras is the nation where the greatest percentage of migrant youth are coming from and turning up on the Texas-Mexico border. I wanted to find out why. 2 weeks before touching down in Honduras, I was on the Texas-Mexico border in the Rio Grande Valley at La Posada Provincia, an emergency shelter for immigrant refugees and asylum seekers who have just crossed the Rio Grande. The shelter is hard to find. It's on the outskirts of San Benito on a rural road. That morning, a woman from Honduras was sitting on the front steps of the shelter's dorm with her crying 2-year-old daughter on her lap, and she told me her story. She did not want to give me her name because it would put her family back in Honduras in danger. She said there is no work in Honduras and no way to make enough money to deal with the rising prices even for basic food items. She came to the United States looking for a better life. Another woman I spoke to at La Posada Provincia told me a similar story. She also wanted to remain anonymous for fears of family reprisals in her home country of El Salvador. She left Central America and came to the United States after gang members demanded extortion payments from her and then punched her in the face. She says a man in a shop in her town refused to pay the gang tax, and he was murdered. So she took her 10-year-old son and fled to the Texas-Mexico border. As she talks to me, her son is sitting nearby and he is sobbing. He's afraid and he's worried that he will never again see his older brother and sister that they left behind in El Salvador. She borrowed $7,000 for the two of them to make the 1,000-mile journey. When she crossed the Rio Grande near Matamoros and Brownsville, she was quickly picked up by the Border Patrol and processed. They gave her an immigration court date, an order to appear. Then she was released to La Posada Provincia. But she calls that order to appear a permiso, as if it's a permit to enter the United States. It is and it isn't. That court date could be months away or even longer. But under the catch-and-release policy that the Border Patrol has been practicing at this time for OTMs other than Mexicans, that permiso could seem like a permit to her and the thousands of others, or at least they've decided to treat it like one. Since July 2013, La Posada has helped more than 1,300 immigrants, most of them from the Central American countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Alma Gonzalez is the shelter's development director. She told me that over the past year, they've seen a tripling of the number of refugees coming through their facilities and needing services. The U.S. Border Patrol apprehended 160,000 undocumented immigrants between October 2013 and this past May. That includes 47,000, a record number of children under 18 who have traveled without parents or a guardian. The situation is being called a humanitarian crisis, and the federal government is struggling to keep up, and nonprofits, charities, and community groups are stepping up to fill the void. The Assembly Hall at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in downtown McAllen, Texas, is normally reserved for parish activities, wedding receptions, and quinceañeras, but not today. The tables are set up in the hall in rows, and they're covered with donated clothing, shoes, baby formula toiletries, all the items that the Catholic Charities coordinator, Ivana Molina Melendez, thinks will be needed by the refugee immigrants showing up in droves at the border.
So, and we feed them, we give clothes, they bath, and we give travel bags for them. If it's going to take 3 days or 4 days travel, so we give to them everything whatever they are going to need.
Melinda says the refugee immigrants have fled their homes in Central America, and they made their way through Mexico, and now they're turning up on the border in a state of desperation.
They got nothing. The only thing they got is the clothes where they crossed the river.
And for many of the refugee immigrants, this is where they crossed the border, at the Hidalgo County Park on the riverbanks of the Rio Grande, right across from a park on the Mexican side. On the Mexican side, there's a lot of activity. Families are playing and swimming in the river. Some are on jet skis, zooming back and forth. On the U.S. side, and it's a different story, the park is basically deserted except for two patrol boats pulling away from the dock, a Border Patrol boat and a Texas Department of Public Safety boat. Both of these patrol boats are heavily armed with multiple machine guns mounted on all sides. About an hour after those boats pulled away, the men on the jet skis are zooming closer to the dock, and then they start dropping off passengers one by one right in front of me. And those passengers who just crossed the border illegally casually walk off into the park.
They're smart. You know, they found a way to make the money. A lot of it's controlled by the drug cartels. They control the whole area down there, and they know where we're at and what we can and can't do, and they take advantage of it.
Chris Cabrera is a Border Patrol agent and a leader in the local Border Patrol union.
The smuggler on the Mexican side will do is he'll come up with a inner tube, he'll load the people in, and he'll bring them over to the U.S. side. He'll never touch solid ground. He'll stay in the water, unload the inner tube, go back, or the raft, do it about five or six times, get about 20, 30 people here, and then he'll point them in the direction of the bridge and just say, walk up that road till you run into a Border Patrol agent. They walk up the road, and, you know, it's easy money for him. He's charging them, you know, thousands of dollars to come across, and he has to put himself at little or no risk.
Now, under this refugee wave, it's become almost routine that every morning dozens of people, mostly women and children, will emerge from the county park and surrender to the Border Patrol. They will be processed, their names, photos, fingerprints taken, and they're given a phone call. The refugees arrive with very little, but with one precious item, a scrap of paper with a phone number on it. With it, they will connect with someone, usually a family member elsewhere in the United States, who will wire them a bus ticket, and then they end up here.
Hi.
This is one of the several bus stations in the Rio Grande Valley. This is the McAllen bus station. Outside, there's a Salvation Army disaster food relief truck. They've set up and they're providing hamburger box lunches to the women and children refugees.
Can you name again, sir?
Juan Mares, M-A-R-E-S. I'm here to help the people that are less fortunate than what we are.
You've done this before?
Oh, yeah, we went to Eagle Pass when they had the floodings a year ago. I was there for a week.
Did you ever think that you would be doing this here in downtown McAllen?
No. No, not ever in my wildest dream. But we're called out for a disaster. Of course, this is not a disaster. It's a humanitarian aid.
It a humanitarian crisis.
Well, it is, you know, for them, because they're... I don't know what the situation is back home. They're here. They're on our footsteps, and we need to help them. It doesn't matter if legally or illegally.
Can you ask before me, when was the last time they had a good meal?
¿Cuándo fue la última vez que tomaron una comida buena?
Ay, Dios, hace como un mes venimos en camino. Ya aguanto el estómago.
The humanitarian crisis that is now on the Texas-Mexico border is a crisis that's been ongoing in the Central American nation for many years. The conditions are so desperate in Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua that the United States has granted many of the immigrants from these countries TPS, temporary protected status. This is the same status offered to other countries in crisis like Somalia and Syria. Jonathan D. Ryan is the executive director of RAICES, Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, based in San Antonio.
The administration can designate that nationals from particular countries who are present in the United States following some sort of natural disaster or a breakdown of civil order in that country can remain in the United States under a temporary protected status that allows them to obtain an identity document and a work permit for usually an 18-month period that is then reviewed by the administration for potential renewal after that time.
So if we already have them for El Salvador and Honduras, why don't they just use that?
So for a person currently to qualify for TPS who is a native of those countries, they would have had to have enrolled in the TPS program back in 1998 or 2001 following Hurricane Mitch or the earthquake that took place in Central America. There are no new enrollments allowed for people from those countries, and individuals who have TPS are not able to request a family reunification with their spouses and minor children, for example.
And it is possible that the Obama administration could give TPS to the refugees, immigrants who are coming up, just based on the fact that the out-of-control violence that the administration has already recognized by issuing travel warnings to these countries and has documented that there is obviously a breakdown in social order.
That's right. We have travel warnings for U.S. citizens who are potentially traveling to these countries. The president has called this an urgent humanitarian crisis. He has involved FEMA in the response. In many ways, this more resembles our nation's response to a humanitarian, a refugee, or natural disaster type crisis than to some kind of an immigration concern.
Jonathan D. Ryan is the executive director of RAICES, Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services. It's based in San Antonio. This is a special edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're investigating what's driving this surge of children coming up from Central America, from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and turning up at the Texas-Mexico border. Back in Honduras, you don't have to look far to see why children are leaving this tropical nation. The country is facing too many challenges, and the government is incapable of addressing them. Instead, people here are left to find their own solutions, find help on their own. It's a scene that can be found in some of the darkest streets of Honduras. As night seizes Tegucigalpa, the streets of one of the capital city's toughest neighborhoods are virtually deserted. Most people here know that it's not safe for anyone to be caught out alone at night. This is where the killer gangs are notorious. But then a bus pulls up and out pour about a dozen young American missionaries. They enter what looks like an abandoned building, but it's a homeless shelter run by a faith-based charity called Breaking Chains Honduras. The volunteers are spending their summer vacation here feeding the homeless in the murder capital of the world. This deadly statistic about Honduras doesn't faze the group's liaison, Courtney Matthews.
So night is go to a place downtown. There's a lot of kids there that we know that come to church with us, or that we just try and build relationships with. Just pass out food and hang out with them for about an hour, just kind of love on them.
She's giving the new volunteers the rundown on what to expect later when they meet the homeless. She says many will be drunk or high on glue, and to watch your valuables.
They'll love taking pictures. They'll love to see the pictures that you take. That being said, if you take a picture of somebody and then you put it in their hand to look at, that might be the last time that you see your cell phone. Not because they're being malicious, but you just handed them something very valuable that they could use.
A heavy rain is now falling, and now there's a power outage. It's as dark as coal, except for this eerie illumination emitting from green and orange glow sticks that one volunteer brought to give away to the children. Matthews' do's and don'ts are uninterrupted, and as the Muncie, Indiana native is talking, a smartphone with a flashlight app is held over her head, casting her in a heavenly glow.
If somebody wants to pray for us real quick, just for safety and good trip and everything like that, that'd be awesome.
Dear God, thank you so much, God, for the group of people gathered here, God, who just really want to connect with you and connect with other people here, God. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Amen.
Courtney is taking the group to a street corner where every night loads of trash gets dumped by the city. The homeless come out to sort through the garbage, salvaging recyclables that they can sell. And they have learned that this is where they also might get a free hot bowl of rice and beans.
And so this is kind of a good spot for us to come because there's a good amount of people already here. And then kids like this that will go through the trash and look for stuff, or they will beg. Some of them will steal, things like that.
The pouring rain doesn't deter the cast-off children. They approach the back of the pickup truck where the serving pot is ready. One volunteer holds up a tarp protecting the pot from the falling rain. Another dishes the food into white styrofoam bowls. Matthews has been doing this work for almost 4 years, and in that time she's gotten to know many of the homeless here, especially the children. And she says she's seen how the murder gangs here have taken their toll.
So we've had a few losses, mainly among the teens, and a lot of it is the ones that we've experienced are people that live on the street or were involved in gang activity.
And Matthews notes that another major problem for Honduras is the lack of family planning, children having children at an alarming rate.
A lot of people here have kids very young and have more kids than they can take care of. And so a lot of the street children here are on the street either due to neglect or because their parents couldn't take care of them or because they bounced around between different family members or different children's homes and then eventually found themselves on the street.
The country's birth rate has led Honduras's population to double about every 25 years. The 1950 census counted 1.3 million inhabitants, almost twice as many as the 1926 census recorded. By 1974, the population had almost doubled again. By July 1992, the population was estimated to be 5 million, and today there are 8 million Hondurans in the nation's borders and an estimated 1 million living in the United States. From around 1950 to 1975, Honduras had the highest birth rate in Latin America. But since the mid-1970s, the birth rate has dropped and steadied somewhat. Despite the rain, some of the volunteers have formed a circle in the street, and they're kicking a hacky sack back and forth. Soon, some of the homeless kids join in the game. But not one homeless youth called Joey. He and his friends are passing around a Coca-Cola bottle holding about half an inch of brown glue. They're spending their night huffing, and they're too high to join in the circle. But Joey sees my recorder, and he wants to tell me his story. Joey says he's 20 years old, but he looks like he could easily pass for 13. In his slurred Spanish, Joey says he's on the street because his mother drinks too much and his father beats him. His family told him to leave the house and never come back. Joey says he knows that many from Honduras are leaving for the United States, and he has an uncle there too. And Joey says he could make that trip, and he would go if something touches his heart. Well, something has touched the hearts of over 10,000 Hondurans this year. More than any other Central American nation, unaccompanied children and single mothers with children are showing up in these staggering numbers at the Texas-Mexico border. And the big question is why? And the question isn't just being asked in the United States. Hondurans also want to know why. The same images in the U.S. media of children being warehoused in Border Patrol detention facilities are also front page news in Honduras. And here TV roundtable talking heads are also debating what's causing this exodus. The consensus is the Honduras out-of-control gang violence, the poverty, and the lack of economic opportunity. But why now? Many in Honduras say the nation has hit a tipping point. The gangs have gotten out of control. They're more aggressive with their extortion demands and the recruitment of teenage boys. They're being forced into the gangs or they're killed. Meanwhile, the Honduran parents who are already in the United States, they're now financially able to hire human smugglers to bring their children to the Texas-Mexico border. And that's the view of Yanina Carranza. She's a 17-year-old girl sitting in a Tegucigalpa park with her school friends. And she adds that the trip to the United States is very dangerous. Some of the children never even make it to the border. They suffer, die, or they disappear into the world of sex trafficking. And when asked if she or her friends would go to the U.S. someday, they said that would depend. They don't want to go, but if they can't find a job here in Tegucigalpa, well, they might. Julio Melendez is a television reporter for Canal 11 in Tegucigalpa, and he's known for his coverage of the streets. He agrees that there are many push factors in Honduras driving this immigration surge, and he says, yes, the top one is poverty.
We have the very poor people here in Honduras. All the families in the colonias live with $1 a day.
Melendez says the other major push factor is the gang violence, which is related to immigration. He says that so many men have left their families in Honduras over the years to work in the United States that it is torn at the nation's social fabric.
And this is the big problem, because here the boys grow up without a father, without institutional support. We have here boys without fathers. And they go into the gangs.
And Melendez says, while there are strong push factors in Honduras, there are also strong pull factors coming from the United States. That strong economy and that glossy American culture, those name brand fast food restaurants and Hollywood entertainments. He rejects the assumption by some in the U.S. that the DREAM Act or changes to the enforcement of U.S. immigration policy is at play here. He says that's not a pull factor. He says children going north to the United States don't know or they're not concerned with American immigration policy. They think they're traveling legally. Not all Honduran children who are cast off by their parents will spend their lives in the streets. The lucky ones end up in a place like this, a home for boys just outside of Tegucigalpa called Hogar Diamante, Diamond Home. Here there is room for 70 boys. They live, they go to school, they take care of the farm animals, and they learn a trade all right here. The home is supported through private donations, the selling of furniture that the boys make, and the government provides two school teachers. Isomara Montoya is the director of the home. She says this is a safe place for the boys away from the gangs. She says the boys here were living in extreme poverty with their families. Many didn't go to school, and they lived in the street. They were being targeted for recruitment by the men in the gangs. But life at the home can also be tough. The rules are strict, and some of the boys have run away. Montoya says some boys get almost a fever to find a missing father that they think is in the United States, and then they are gone. So the goal now of the United States government is to reduce those push factors in Honduras and other Central American source nations. And the best way to do that is by creating more economic opportunity in Honduras. And recently, the White House announced plans to increase international cooperation and spending in the U.S. aid program for Central America. Ricardo Zuniga is the Senior Director for Western Hemisphere Affairs in the National Security Council.
That we've been working with the governments of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, as well as with the Mexican government from the beginning of this increase in migration. And in all cases, what we found is a high level of interest in working with us because they understand the humanitarian nature of what it is that we're trying to do and the fact that we're all interested, first and foremost, in preventing the dangerous migration of children, particularly as we've seen an increase in children under 12 years of age. They all have an interest in making sure that their citizens are well cared for.
Generally, most of the U.S. aid going to Central America has been for the fighting of the drug war. Mexican drug cartels have set up shop in Honduras, and they're using the nation as a way station between Colombia, where the drugs originate, and the United States, where the drugs are bought and consumed. The other area of focus for the U.S. aid has been successful in working with rural development and helping farmers in Central America find new markets. But the Honduran crisis of gang violence and the flight of the children to the U.S. is generally coming from the urban centers, and that's going to require a new strategy. And for those who object to the U.S. foreign aid being spent on Central America, one might do the math and discover which is more cost-effective, supporting a multi-billion dollar border patrol, immigration detention facilities, deportation flights, and an immigration court system, or developing the economy and institutions for the country of origin and solving the humanitarian crisis at its source. Standing outside a Rio Grande Valley Border Patrol detention facility where thousands of children were being housed at that time, South Texas Congressman Henry Cuellar says he is also asking that question.
And the Border Patrol, the strong men and women that are securing the border, they said, we cannot enforce ourselves out of this crisis. So if they think that just putting Border Patrol, that's going to solve the problem, it's not.
Cuellar wants more federal resources for border security, but he also wants the State Department to take Central American issues much more seriously. And by putting more development dollars into Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, the U.S. could relieve some of those push factors there, and it would be cheaper and more effective.
Where is the attention of the United States? It's not south. They think that all we have to do is play defense on the one-yard line, which is the U.S.-Mexico border right here. This is what it means when we play defense on the one-yard line. We're seeing this right here behind me.
So what is next for this crisis? Despite U.S. efforts to deliver a message to the people of Honduras and other Central American nations that this journey is too dangerous and that they will be turned back, deported when they arrive, the flow of children, some unaccompanied, others with their single mothers, is showing no sign of slowing down. There are protections for these juvenile immigrant refugees in current U.S. law, and deporting them will be costly and complicated. So the question continues to be, why are they coming? Stepping out of the Tegucigalpa airport and onto the street, I could see why. Burger King, KFC, Fridays, and other American brand names all lining the street. The United States has built its franchises here as part of the global economy. The U.S. has done well exporting products and images. The United States is a shining city on a hill, just as President Ronald Reagan called the nation in his 1984 acceptance speech of the Republican Party nomination and his 1989 farewell speech to the nation. But the phrase has a history deeper than that. It was coined by Puritan John Winthrop in his 1630 sermon, A Model of Christian Charity. Winthrop admonished the future Massachusetts Bay colonist. He said their new community would be as a city upon a hill, watched by the world. He wanted the Puritan community in New England to set an example of communal charity, affection, and unity to the world. But if they failed, the colony's actions would also be witnessed by the rest of the world. Why are the children of Central America coming to the U.S. border? Because America is a shining city on the hill, flashing neon lights, shining brightly as a promise in their developing nation. The question is, what will the world witness now that this crisis is on our doorstep? That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email me at texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can comment directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. And you can find us on iTunes and tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.